Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And how do parents know how their kids are doing in school? Well, tests are one way, and the proliferation of tests in public schools has certainly been one of the most controversial developments in education in this century. If you have kids in elementary school, you probably have noted the weight of their backpacks, right? Can you even pick them up? Lugging books and homework back and forth, you worry about their neck muscles, their tired eyes, their stress. In fact, parents only have their own experiences to go on to judge how their kids are doing. And if parents got a lot of homework, then their kids should have it, right? If parents' school years were free of tests, then their kids don't need tests to excel. If parents remember IQ tests and standardized reading tests that placed them in advanced tracks in elementary school, then such programs are reassuring to parents with their own kids in school today.
I want the best for my daughter. I don't want her just prepared enough, which is kind of what I feel like the no homework policy is doing, is just preparing kids enough. I want her to be prepared par excellence. I want for her to grow into a strong, intelligent woman who can answer the world on the path she takes. And I don't think that this new homework policy from TS 116 is going to take her there.
That's Daniel Tasman, the father of an 8-year-old, and he's not comfortable with a new homework policy at his child's public school, ending homework for pre-K through 5th grades. Mr. Tasman told us he wants to take his daughter out of the school. The principal at this school, PS 116 in Manhattan, Jane Hsu, says she understands the parental reaction, is sticking with her decision for no homework, and told us, quote, "I'm sure there are national experts who would be thrilled to chime in on your radio program on the decisions our school has made. If anything, I love that our little school has created a worldwide conversation around homework and what is beneficial for our young learners." Well, we found two national experts. David Elkind is professor emeritus of child development at Tufts University, author of The Hurried Child, The Power of Play and Miseducation. He's in favor of eliminating homework in grade school. Is that about right, David?
Yeah, pretty much.
And Kathy Vatterott is a professor of education at the University of Missouri at St. Louis and author of Rethinking Homework, Best Practices That Support Diverse Needs. Where do you fall on the homework question, Kathy?
Well, I'm kind of in the middle. I think that a little homework is okay if it's done correctly, but I would not have a big problem if there was no homework in elementary school, but I do see some value in having some homework.
Kathy, relate to Mr. Tasman's sense that he's going to take his kid out of the school because he doesn't feel that his student will be prepared par excellence if there's no homework. And I suspect he's using his own experience as a bit of a guide here.
Well, I think there is a fallacy that exists out there that homework is absolutely necessary to prepare kids. And we're making an assumption there that if there is no homework, that these kids will not learn. And in fact, the research is very clear that they can't prove a benefit in the lower grades for homework.
So what is the value of homework when it's done properly in your view, Kathy?
For the K-5 children, I think there's a couple of things that are really valuable. I think building the habit of bringing something home, taking it out, doing something with it, and getting it back to school, I think the habit is important. I think establishing ownership of whose job is it, that it's the kid's job and not the parent's job. I think those are the most important things to me. But that can be done with a very small amount of homework. That can be done with 10 minutes for first grade, 20 minutes for second grade, et cetera.
David Elkind, what are you seeing in the proliferation of homework in some public schools?
Well, the problem I see is not necessarily per se homework. It's that too many kids tell me that the teacher just checks the homework off and doesn't read it. Now, the value of any kind of homework is that it's a learning experience. The teacher reads it, responds to it. Kids put a lot of time and effort in homework. If it's not responded to properly, if it's not read and just checked off, then it's, you know, it turns kids off to learning rather than turning them on to learning. Teachers have 3 or 4 5 classes, 25, 30 kids to class? Are they going to read 100 papers every night? I mean, sometimes it doesn't make a lot of sense. And so homework often tends to be just busy work, and learning should be a fun experience. And the earlier we teach children that learning is fun and exciting, the better they'll do. And if homework turns them off very early, then it has the negative effect rather than a positive effect.
What do you make of the Khan Academy notion that actually homework is best done in class with teachers supervising the actual work in the classroom, and that it's better to hear lecture presentations on video at home later on out of class, Mr. Alkind?
Yeah, it makes a certain amount of sense. At least there is somebody who is looking over the homework, responding to it. That's just the point I was trying to make, that it becomes more meaningful if the teacher responds to it and gives the child feedback immediately as to whether it's right or wrong, whether he's doing it well or so on. Learning is always a feedback between the teacher and the learner. And if there's no feedback, then it's not a learning experience. And with the flipped classroom, as you've described it, at least the teacher is there interacting with the kids and what they're doing. We know that the most effective learning is the amount of time that there is between the teacher and the learner. And the more time there is between teacher and learner, the more effective the learning is. And with that kind of arrangement, it certainly increases the amount of time that the teacher is spending with each student.
Kathy Vatterott, I remember having a great time doing big reports and projects. I mean, maybe I'm just kind of a geek in the fifth and sixth grade, writing these reports about the Roman Empire and the, you know, Mesopotamia and all that sort of thing. And in some of the case of my own kids, group projects that did involve a certain amount of intensive homework were, it seemed, very, very valuable as young as even in third and fourth grade. What do you make of that?
Oh, I think projects are fine. I think the piece that's missing here is that, are we doing high interest tasks, and are we doing things that kids are capable of doing? When we send home the rote work, do the 30 problems, this is not motivating to kids. My child never had a problem doing projects that were high interest and that were kind of geared to his level of learning.
And this school in Manhattan, though, is going to just basically substitute play for homework. And that's what they believe is going to be more valuable than any homework assignment they could have given. Kathy Vatterott, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm curious as to whether that is their formal policy, is that, oh, we're not doing homework, we're playing, which is developmentally appropriate for kids, as David can tell you. But I think what's happening is that they're responding to a concern from parents that kids don't have enough downtime, that kids are overscheduled. I think the other concern that is that they're trying to meet the needs of a very great diversity of parents. I always say, you know, we have tiger moms and we have parents that have free range kids, and we're trying to accommodate all of those differences. And I would just say that if parents are concerned at that school about their child not having homework, there is no reason why parents can't create tasks for their child to do. And some schools actually will provide optional homework for those parents who feel like they need for their child to be doing more work.
Good point. Before we go, David Alkind, what do you mean when you say the power of play?
Well, the play is a very important part of the way in which children learn. And if you combine learning with play, then you have the most effective kind of learning available. And, you know, most good teachers try to make their learning into games, playing whether math games or whether it's history games. And if it's exciting and interesting, like projects, then kids want to do it. But if it's just, you know, doing problems at home that are really not very interesting at all, then you're turning learning off. So the extent that you can get children to be innovative and to do their own things, which is the play thing, is the part is adding their own moment to it. And that's what makes learning interesting, when it's not just something that's forced upon you. And certainly by the end of elementary school, projects can be very important. And they're long-term projects. It's not that it happens overnight. Usually it takes the kid maybe the whole semester to do a project, which is exciting too.
What's your view on homework? We'd love to know at 877-8MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. We've been speaking with David Alkind, Professor Emeritus of Child Development at Tufts University, author of The Hurried Child, The Power of Play and Miseducation. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Kathy Vatterott is a professor of education at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, author of Rethinking Homework, Best Practices That Support Diverse Needs. Kathy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Donna Harrison calling from Oakland, California. Yes, yes, yes. As an elementary school teacher, I really understood how important playtime was when I had my own son. I realized how severely lots of homework cut into our family time. My teaching day didn't end until his homework was done. I also understood all too well the terrible discrepancy between families who had the time and the language skills to supervise or assist their children and those who don't.
This is Nikki from Oakland, California. Homework can be an intentional part of playtime, such as learning about measurements by cooking with a parent, or learning about gravity by making and flying a kite with a sibling. The piles of busy work that create homework are what needs eliminating.
This is Mark Mannheimer calling from Bradford, Massachusetts. I feel it is important for a child to have a foundation of schoolwork that builds their understanding and awareness of the need to do independent work and studying to get the most out of their education. As a college professor, I see the consequences of this lack of preparation frequently.
My name is James. I'm 7. I go to school in Brooklyn. My dad says I don't have to do homework. I could play chess all day if I call for the radio show. I did it.
Hey there, Zane. It sounds like you have a radio chess dad. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and you can play chess all day. Later in the hour, the joy of teaching and learning with only the eyes and ears and heart. Here, actor Ethan Hawke tells his friend Seymour Bernstein how much he learned about acting from being a mentor to young Eller Coltrane in the years of shooting the Oscar-nominated film Boyhood.
This whole Boyhood experience that I've been on, and I've been working with this young man, Eller Coltrane, for years, and watching him kind of reach adulthood, I have been learning so much from him. I never thought about it because I've kind of taken on the hat of being a mentor to him, right? I'm an older actor, and I'm walking him through this gauntlet of the Oscars and publicity and all this kind of very treacherous water. But I realize that his idealism has been teaching me and keeping me focused throughout.
Did you coach him during the film?
Well, I tried to, but the funny thing is I've now that I think back and I listen to what you're saying, I realize I think he probably helped me more than I helped
him.
How
interesting. You know, that's interesting.
Working with him on what he should say, helped me think about what I wanted to say. And just asking him simple questions. Well, Eller, what do you believe in? What do you want to put out there? You're going to be interviewed by 60 Minutes? What do you want to say? Well, let's work on it. But nobody ever asked me that anymore, but now it helped me a lot. I hadn't thought of it.
Ethan Hawke and pianist and music teacher Seymour Bernstein talk about how learning to love is bigger than loving to learn later this hour, a life of mentoring in the arts. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com, TIAA-CREF. A financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
It's getting ugly on Capitol Hill, so what else is new? Regarding Iran, Republicans are warning Iran that any deal in its nuclear program can be reversed once President Obama leaves office. In a letter to Iran, GOP senators vowed to nullify an unacceptable deal, quote, with the stroke of a pen, once there's a new president in the White House. On Capitol Hill, this is sounding like an argument between hardliners and moderates with President Obama, the great Satan. Here's Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid.
When it comes to preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear bomb, we should put partisanship way to one side. Sadly, though, the judgment of my Republican colleagues seems to be clouded by their abhorrence of President Obama.
In response to the Republican letter, Democrats in the administration have said it has no legal value and only serves to undermine the efforts being made toward a negotiation with Iran. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, is with us. Hi, Todd.
Hi, John.
How worried is the White House about all of this?
Well, the White House is upset, concerned. A statement from Joe Biden last night blistering against Senate Republicans. Joe Biden was a member of the Senate for 36 years, of course. He said that this letter, signed by 47 Republicans only, no Democrats, as you mentioned, was, in his words, beneath the dignity of an institution that I revere. So Tom Cotton, who is the brand new freshman Republican senator from Arkansas and a former military man himself, has had his say several times on the network news. Here was Cotton today on MSNBC explaining why he wrote the letter, what he was thinking.
Iran's leaders have to understand that while the president negotiates agreements under our Constitution, Congress approves agreements. And if Congress doesn't approve agreement, then no future Congress nor future president is bound by that agreement, just as Barack Obama himself has repudiated agreements that were not approved in a formal fashion by the United States Congress.
Not bound by an agreement? Well, that's a little bit of a misreading. I mean, it is true that the Senate advises and consents and has the power to approve a treaty, but this wouldn't be a treaty.
This is not a treaty, and some of this is constitutional semantics, and in fact, some of this has reached the level of almost zingers in comedy. The Iranian foreign minister himself, Javad Zarif, issued his own statement yesterday evening instructing Tom Cotton that maybe he's the one that doesn't understand United States internal politics and Senate imperatives. He said this isn't a treaty. He said the United States is still bound by international law, regardless of whether the Senate approves it or not. He said lots of other agreements have been made by presidents. Other people have pointed out the Vietnam War was ended without the consent of Congress. Hostages in Iran were freed without the consent of Congress. So that part's not unprecedented. And a little bit of this has become tit for tat. But some of the most important stuff here, John, are the Republicans who did not sign the letter. And there were seven of them, in particular, Bob Corker, who's the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. Bob Corker does want Congress to weigh in. Bob Corker does have a bipartisan bill that would give Congress an up or down vote on this deal and give Congress more control over dialing back sanctions if the White House and the P5 plus one do reach a nuclear deal with Iran. Bob Corker wants that to get to a 67 vote veto proof majority. Listen.
I just felt like, as chairman of the committee, who's working with ranking member and others to get to a place where we had 67 votes, that it was probably not something that was going to be helpful in that effort for me to be involved in it.
So he doesn't see 67 votes here necessarily.
Well, he thinks that he was getting close to 67 votes, and that's where he wants to be. The problem is he thinks that this letter might make it much more partisan, cause Democrats to head to their corners, and that he won't get there. And he has reason to believe that. His bill is bipartisan, has lots of Democrats on board. When last week, after Netanyahu's speech, widely viewed by Democrats to be a partisan injection into foreign affairs, when that came up, that speech in the House, Democrats said they wouldn't support going to Corker's bill this week. Mitch McConnell wanted to do that. So Corker said, geez, the Democrats think this is getting too political. Well, then this letter happens, and Corker suspects that again, that that might be happening. And listen to Susan Collins as well. She's from Maine. She didn't sign the letter.
Don't think that the Ayatollah is going to be particularly convinced by a letter from members of the Senate, even one signed by a number of my distinguished and high-ranking colleagues.
Let's look at the mechanics here a little bit. Now, if the Republicans have their way, I mean, what would they do here? There's a deal that the Obama administration signs with Iran that results in a lifting of sanctions, and then Iran does some sort of business regarding assurances on nuclear centrifuges and the like. There's nothing the Senate can do to affect what Iran does. It would just be they would restore sanctions regardless of what Iran does with its nuclear program.
There are lots and lots of different moving parts here. For Tom Cotton's part, he has said in the past that his intention is to derail a deal. He said that in January at a conservative conference. So his intentions, even though now he says he doesn't want to derail a deal, he wants a good deal. In the past, he said he wanted to blow up one altogether. Now, to your question, John, there are lots and lots of moving parts. Let's say a deal does get made. It would probably entail the White House using its authority to dial back on some sanctions that Iran suffers from today. That's the whole point for Iran. They're really, really bristling under economic sanctions from the whole world. They want out from under those. They want to be able to sell oil. The White House does have some power to dial back on those sanctions. The White House doesn't have the legal power to make sanctions go away. away altogether. And in the medium to long term, that's why Congress will have to be part of this. Can they turn around and undeal with a stroke of a pen the way Tom Cotton says they could, or a future president? That's iffy, probably not. And you're right, this isn't a treaty. But what Corker wants is more control in the short term for Congress to restrict the president from even being able to turn the dial on sanctions as we test Iran's good faith in curtailing their enrichment and shutting down centrifuges. In the medium to long term, it's up to Congress to lift the laws, to change the laws that have long-term sanctions on Iran.
One scenario, it's a lot of silly rhetoric that goes away once this deal is signed. Second scenario, though, this is a separation of powers issue. This, it could get that way, couldn't it?
It's sort of turned into that. A lot of people are accusing Republicans of sort of denying that Barack Obama is actually the president. In other ways, John, this letter was really a glorified press release. It's not clear that any letter was actually sent to the Ayatollahs. It was a public letter, an open letter in Washington. Sometimes that's a doublespeak for a big glorified press release that gets lots of coverage.
Published in the Washington Times. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
In a state with an enormous coastline, 1,200 miles of it, Florida, you would think, has to be vigilant about sea levels and the effects of global warming. But in Florida, home of Disney World, some aspects of reality can be stretched, apparently, to accommodate Florida politics. Climate change may be a case in point. The Florida Department of Environmental Protection says that any assertion that employees have been banned from using the words global warming or climate change is completely false. That's right, completely false. But Florida's Center for Investigative Reporting says that's what DEP employees are telling them. They're actually banned from using those words. Christopher Byrd was Assistant General Counsel for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection from 2008 to 2013. Christopher, were you under any kind of a ban?
Yes. So actually, after Rick Scott became governor and appointed the new secretary to the Department of Environmental Protection, our supervisors in the Office of General Counsel called a staff meeting and instructed the lawyers that if we wanted to keep our jobs, we wouldn't use terms like global warming, sustainability, or sea level rise.
And so that's actually consistent with the Florida Department's statement that there is no ban. It's completely false because it was just delivered to you verbally.
It was not written. That is true. There's no official ban, I believe. However, those words were highly discouraged from being used and actually scrubbed from reports and presentations that staff was making and had delivered.
Well, I can't resist characterizing it this way, but I gather that this would amount to a chilling effect on talk about global warming.
Very much so. At that time, I represented the Coral Reef Conservation Program in Miami. And when you're trying to conserve the continental United States' only coral reef tract, you have to identify and realize the effects that global warming, ocean acidification, and sea level rise are having on our coral reefs.
So how would you even talk about this? I mean, would you go, I mean, what would you say when you came to talking about global warming?
Well, the employees in that program did relate to me times where they were addressing the public and trying to do public outreach and education and would simply say, we understand that global warming is an issue, but we are not allowed to go there. It was very transparent.
And what did people who you dealt with who are sophisticated about the questions of, you know, sea level rise and actually have a stake in this, what did they think about your behavior?
The behavior was not so surprising for folks that were familiar with Rick Scott's politics here in Florida. You know, when he first came into office, there were mass layoffs of senior scientists and experts within the Department of Environmental Protection statewide.
Now, if I were to call the DEP and run by that statement, what do you think they would say, that the DEP was under Rick Scott helping the polluters and violators?
Oh, no, they would never agree to that. They would say that they did, in fact, change to a compliance assistance regime rather than an enforcement regime. That's been their policy since 2011. And the numbers show since that time that the number of active cases that the Office of General Counsel has opened has plummeted.
And you're a lawyer, right, Christopher Byrd?
Yes, I am.
So pretty amazing. Just get rid of global warming just by erasing the words. That's pretty astounding.
Well, it wasn't so astounding because it didn't get rid of global warming.
Christopher Byrd, Assistant General Counsel for the Florida Department of Environmental Protection from 2008 to 2013. Christopher, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at ShopKeep.com.
For all the mindless toil of working alone at home trying to perfect anything, doing math homework, your chemistry homework, practicing scales on the piano, for all that, there are also the magical moments of the gentle guidance from a memorable teacher.
Don't let go of this E until it's time to play it, and then it'll sound perfect. Ah. Now, a dream.
That's Seymour Bernstein, 87-year-old teacher of music, who, let's just say, is not a fan of the movie Whiplash. For generations of piano students, Seymour Bernstein says he has been the student, learning always from his pupils, living his art. That idea was something of a holy grail for a troubled, brilliant, successful actor, Ethan Hawke, who found himself seated next to Seymour at a dinner party years ago. A great friendship was born that became a documentary. Seymour, An Introduction, is a love song to art and teaching and music. And will give no one whiplash.
Well, I kind of think that our movie is the photo negative of that movie, that there is a tremendous amount you can get out of people with hostility and rage and torture. And the real mystery to me is, and much more interesting question, is how to do it without doing that. You know, what Seymour's all about, what the movie is about, his teaching is about drawing the best from ourselves and being in control and having agency of our own art, not being manipulated and abused.
How were you drawn together, Seymour? Describe the event that brought you guys together.
Well, I have a pupil who is a friend of Ethan's, and one night he called me and said, I'd like you to come to dinner. Ethan Hawke is going to be there. And you know what I said? Who is Ethan Hawke?
You know, I was going to ask if you were going to say that. But,
I had to Google him, yeah. And when I did, I said, oh, my God. My first feeling was, why does he want to make a documentary on the likes of me? I'm not so special. But then I realized in discussion with Ethan, and he told me straight out, what I want to promote in this movie is a sense of what happens to us when we have a passion for an art form and we follow it through, and what effect does that have on our lives, not only on the art form. And, you know, that's the core of how I live.
Ethan, in your work, there's such a sense of authenticity and rawness in the moments that you go for. Did you have such a moment in filming this?
I venture to say the entire experience. I really did never want to make a documentary. I felt I'd never heard anyone speak about integrating their development as a working craftsman with their development as a human being. That if you could actually integrate your work, you know, so often men, women, they go to the office and they pour themselves in their job and then they come home and they're kind of half asleep through their family life. Or some people are passionate about their family life and half asleep through their working life, you know. And the beautiful thing about the arts is, not to be corny about it, but at its best, it can have a similar relationship to that of a spiritual tradition, meaning that what makes your art relevant and vibrant is something that's happening inside of you, you know? When Marlon Brando is on the waterfront, he's sharing something deeply personal to him and to his friend Elia Kazan, and they're putting that on the celluloid, and you pay money and you see it. There's some blood in there. There's something real when you see a Picasso painting. You know, I mean, all this stuff. When you hear a Beatles record, I mean, it's all the stuff of their life. And so if you could integrate your development as a human being to positive ends, both in your art and your life, so that being a better actor made me a better husband, you know, what if you could do that? What if being a better actor would make me a better father? And I felt instinctually that there is a connection there. But I never heard anybody say it. In fact, young people are often kind of given this talent myth that to be talented is permission to be a drug-abusing, sure, self-centered, yeah, narcissist, right? And so Seymour was kind of showing me a path, an alternate path.
I've observed, I know Ethan now for almost 3 years, and I have observed amazing changes in him. There is no longer any question about his identity. I have a feeling he knows his identity, that the actor and the person are one and the same. They're not separated. So it works this way, very similarly to all the arts work this way. Let's say they should work this way. I'm working on a Beethoven sonata. That entails my emotional world, my intellectual world, and my physical world, right? Well, let's say that you learn to integrate it in your art form. Isn't it foolish to walk away from your art form into your social world and leave that integration behind? This is when artists get into serious trouble. So I've noticed this guy, I've watched him for 3 years now. He's harmonized now.
Wow.
He's quite different.
You know, you bring up in one of my favorite moments where I learned about acting was at a Willie Nelson concert, right? I'd been, through a friend of a friend, I'd been given some really good seats. In my particular box they had, I could kind of see backstage. I saw through the curtain, and I saw him back there, and he was chatting with the other musicians, and he was completely relaxed, right? And I watched him walk from backstage onto stage with no change, no shift in his energy at all. And almost every, I've spent my life going backstage, and you know, you normally get to somebody's dressing room, and it's pulsing and vibrating with this weird energy, and you're backstage, and you watch there. It's almost like their skin ripples when they walk on stage. Something shifts. Their whole energy makeup changes. But not with Willie Nelson. It was the same guy. And I went backstage, got invited, and there was no nervous anxiety backstage. None. And I realized, oh, this is what I want. It is a goal of mine. And this integrity of self is a worthy pursuit, I think.
Well, what a great conversation. Willie, Ethan, Seymour, we went everywhere. Thanks, guys, so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
The new documentary is called Seymour, An Introduction. It opens in limited release this Friday. You can hear an extended version of this interview by visiting our website at thetakeaway.org. And here's something to take with you. On the threshold of the teen years, some young people don't want to jump. They just want to stand there forever. Listen.
I want to stay a child. I want to stay young. I don't want to grow up. I don't want to have that much responsibility.
Being 12 means being who you are. What do you like? Do you like your hair down? Like types of clothes?
A kid, like a
mature kid.
Yeah, my voice is changing, but I don't really like, I don't want my voice to change.
I just keep growing. I have no idea when I'm going to stop, and that's the scary part.
I'm not quite a teenager. I'm like on the last stretch, the last 50 meters of the race.
Hold on to those years, but it's not so scary this far down the track. Voices from Being 12, a project from our co-producer WNYC, and you can find out more about it and listen back to anything on our program at thetakeaway.org. Follow me on Twitter. I'm @JHockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.